for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 1 year ago, the world appeared on the verge of a second Great Depression. Some analysts believe the crisis could have been averted or at least lessened by heeding the warnings of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. That agency was concerned about a growing market that lacked transparency and was mostly unregulated. Joining me in the studio to talk about the rise of the secretive multi-trillion-dollar derivatives market, its role in the financial crisis, and what's being done to prevent another meltdown, former CFTC senior regulator Michael Greenberger, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration, Martin Bailey, and Greg Ipp. He's U.S. economics editor for The Economist. I hope you'll join us. We'll try to bring clarification to a very complex issue. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org, and you can join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Michael Greenberger, you take a crack at, in as simple terms as possible, explaining what a derivative is.
Well, the most classic derivative and the way derivatives got started were farmers who essentially wanted to buy insurance products so that when they planted seed, by the time the harvest occurred, they will have locked in a price that would guarantee them some form of profit. If the real market didn't give them the profit, they could shift over to the so-called futures market. If the real market gave them a profit, they could get out of their so-called insurance contract. Now, technically, these are called futures contracts. So the value of that insurance is completely dependent on whether or not it's going to be used. In other words, if prices are going against the farmer, the insurance product becomes valuable. It's marketable. He can sell it to someone else if they want it. So the rule up to December of 2000 was any contract of that nature had to be traded on a fully transparent, regulated exchange with capital adequacy, anti-fraud, and anti-manipulation. In the 80s and the 90s, the banks, and we call them swaps dealers now, developed an instrument called a swap. And simply put, in its most classic and benign sense, if you take out a mortgage on your house that has an adjustable rate, you could go to a bank, and for a fee, they will pay the adjustable rate, and they will negotiate a fixed rate for you. So say you've got a mortgage at 6% and you think interest rates are going to go up and you may have to pay 7, 8, or 9%. You go to the bank and the bank undertakes the obligation to pay the increase and you pay them a fixed rate. Now, they do that at a cost. And if they feel they're at risk, they go buy themselves an insurance product to lay their risk off. That market was deemed, just by the say-so, as being, it was absolutely the kind of market that should have been regulated. The bank said it wasn't.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland School at the Center for Health and Homeland Security, former senior regulator at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Greg Ipp, do you want to add to that definition?
Sure. Well, a derivative basically is a contract whose value is derived from something else, such as a currency, an interest rate, the price of corn. And as Michael was saying, the first derivatives were quite straightforward. You know, a farmer wanted to lock in the price of his harvest, so he would buy a contract to sell his corn 6, 9 months hence. Well, financial innovation and cleverness being what it is, we now have countless types of derivatives. And in the current context, the one that most people are now quite worried by is something called a credit derivative, which is essentially a contract that allows me to lend money, say, to Michael, and then buy insurance from Martin in case Michael fails to pay me back. And this sounds like a sensible idea. You know, a bank makes a loan, they'd like a little bit of protection. But it kind of got out of hand to the point that at the height of the bubble in 2007, the amount of the notional value, if you will, of these contracts was $60 trillion. And a lot of that money was not designed to provide legitimate lenders with protection. A lot of it was actually people taking speculative positions. And we now know that a lot of those derivatives were entered into by firms like AIG, American International Group, that had virtually no oversight from the biggest bank regulators. And when the crisis broke, we discovered that they had offered to pay this type of insurance on those toxic subprime mortgages that we've heard so much about. And their inability to make good on that insurance is why they almost failed.
Greg Ipp, he's U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Martin Bailey, are derivatives inherently bad, or are they, you know, inherently good, but depending on how they're managed, then they get off track?
I think derivatives are essential to the working of our modern economy. They're absolutely necessary for companies, particularly those that are trading around the world. They play an enormous role in allowing people to concentrate on that part of business that they know about, they're good about, good at, and pass off some of the risk, whether it's exchange rate risk or interest rate risk, to other people. So I think they're really an essential part of our modern economy, and they may even have gotten a bit of a bad rap in this crisis. As I agree with Greg, that it was these credit default swaps, particularly those that were concentrated in AIG, that got us into trouble. Normally, when you have a derivative, there's a swap, so there's somebody on one side or the other. It can be very helpful for international trade, for example. Someone in the U.S. wants to trade to Germany. Someone in Germany wants to trade to the U.S. They can both eliminate some of the risk of the exchange rate change that might otherwise get in the way of that. What happened here is that this class of derivatives, credit default swap derivatives, were issued in huge numbers by AIG and a few other entities, and there was really no capital, no collateral put up against them, because nobody believed that the price of housing was going to fall and that we were going to get into this kind of trouble. So my answer would be they're not only good, they're essential, but we do need to make sure that we don't get into the same trouble we got into this time around.
Of course, you were on the Council of Economic Advisors in the 1990s. Were derivatives then something that regulators worried about?
They worried about them, but I think there were mistakes made. It wasn't just the administration. It was also the Federal Reserve decided that there was no need to regulate these derivatives at all, and I think that was a mistake. I think the main regulation that's needed probably is to provide information about derivatives. If markets had known, if we had known, that these huge pools of credit default swaps were out there, markets would have reacted, and I don't think we would have had quite the same trouble. But I think there were mistakes made in the 90s in not providing enough information about derivatives and not regulating derivatives adequately.
Are you saying that had there been sufficient regulation that we might not have seen a crisis as huge as we've had?
Well, I think there are a lot of causes to this crisis, and the underlying cause is that all around the world, the risk premium fell, and no one was taking risk generally as seriously as they should have. And so this crisis might have manifested itself in a different way. If we'd had better regulation of derivatives, I think it would have helped. We would have had a smaller crisis. But I think there were a lot of ingredients that went into this crisis.
Martin Bailey, he's at the Brookings Institution. He was chair of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration from 1999 to 2001. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. I want to go back over the history of this whole process a little bit, because it seems to me that unless we understand what happened, it could, in fact, happen again. And Michael Greenberger, I want to ask you about Brooksley Bourne, who she is and what role she played in this crisis.
To put this in context, Brooksley Bourne, by the time she became the chair of the CFTC in 1996, was a legend among lawyers in the D.C. Bar, and for that matter, nationwide. Had she chosen, she could have been president of the ABA and or president of the D.C. Bar. She was a very excellent litigator who specialized in derivatives, but I think more important, she had a national reputation as someone who fought causes for the public interest, women's rights, consumer rights, environmental rights. She was very seriously considered to be Clinton's choice for attorney general because of a longstanding friendship through American Bar Association activities with Hillary Clinton. She did not get that job, but she did become the chair of the CFTC. And I would just say, with regard to my fellow commentators here, I agree with them in spirit. I disagree in tone about the dangers of these products. And Brooksley, in 1998, tried to get the Clinton administration and Alan Greenspan to do something about what she saw as a danger to the economy.
We're going to hear more about that when we come back. Michael Greenberger is at the University of Maryland Law School. Short break. And we're talking in this hour about the multi-trillion dollar derivatives market, what role it played in the financial meltdown, whether there is sufficient regulation at work today, and how our guests see the future of these derivatives. Michael Greenberger, just before the break, you had begun to talk about Brooksley Bourne and the role she tried to play in bringing these derivatives in line.
Yes, well, she came into office in 1996. By 1998, chair of the CFTC. By that time, Orange County had gone bankrupt. Now, today, we're so used to bankruptcies that doesn't sound very dramatic. At the time, it was shocking that a county would go bankrupt because they misunderstood their use of unregulated derivative products. There was a major scandal on Wall Street where Bankers Trust was claimed by Procter & Gamble to have defrauded Procter & Gamble, knowing that they were doing so, and their case was supported by tapes with the Bankers Trust traders laughing up their sleeve and how they took Procter & Gamble to the cleaners. There was uniform concern. At one point, Congress, because of these events, wanted to do something aggressive about it. The GAO recommended that something aggressive be done about it. Brooksley viewed what was then somewhere between a $13 trillion and $27 trillion market. By the way, worldwide notional value, it's now $592 trillion, 13 times the size of our annual GDP. But she foresaw exactly what was going to happen. These were unregulated markets. Nobody was getting information about them. None of the commitments, like the commitments AIG made and $400 billion, were backed by capital. There was no anti-fraud protection, no anti-manipulation.
And she attempted to bring all this to the attention of Alan Greenspan and others.
She wanted to issue a white paper to be commented on so that information could be collected. She wasn't even proposing a regulatory scheme. And long story short, in a very violent meeting chaired by Secretary Rubin and attended by Alan Greenspan and Arthur Levitt.
And Larry Summers.
By the way, Arthur Levitt has since recanted his involvement in this. They, in very tough terms, told her that if she did this, they didn't use these words, but the message is this would be the end of her. She did it. And Phil Graham and many others hounded her for months and months. And at the behest of Bob Rubin, Alan Greenspan, and Arthur Levitt, who issued a statement the day she issued the white paper, they asked Congress to stop her from doing anything on this. And Congress almost unanimously agreed to do so.
Greg, what else was going on?
Well, let me mention a name that we almost never hear about any longer, but Enron Corporation in the late 1990s had ambitions to be a major player in the trading of energy derivatives. And if Enron had been required to do all those things, all those trades through highly regulated exchanges, the business would have been far less profitable. So they had a very powerful interest in not seeing Brooks Lee Bourne's proposal that these things be regulated see the light of day. And so they had a very formidable lobbying operation in Washington that they brought to bear on this. Now, a few years after Brooks Lee Bourne had left the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Phil Graham, the Republican chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, steered through Congress a overhaul of our commodity laws, which passed during the lame duck session in 2000. And it basically, once and for all, said these swaps can no longer be regulated by the CFTC. Now, I do want to add one thing. There was two major reasons why the banks and Enron and Greenspan and Rubin and Summers opposed this. One was the somewhat parochial, self-interested reason that the banks made a lot of money by trading these things in, you know, their own rooms, in trading rooms, instead of on transparent exchanges. But the other was that for years these swaps had been growing in a legal no man's land. It had never been made quite clear whether these things were really just, you know, one-to-one contracts in which you could do any way you wanted, or whether these were actually futures, just like those that had been traded on corn and oil for decades. Because if they were futures, then by law, they had to adhere to all the CFTC's rules. And the thing that Rubin and Summers and Greenspan kept emphasizing was that Brooks Lee Bourne was casting a pall of legal uncertainty over these things. Gosh, if this thing went through, all the people who had entered into these contracts would suddenly walk away from them because they would say they're illegal, and they were afraid that would bring the financial system down. Almost certainly those threats were exaggerated, but it was a legitimate thing to worry about.
Yeah, I just have to intervene at this point. That is a fallacy about what Brooks Lee did. In the white paper, it said, in bold terms, anything the CFTC did would be prospective only. It had the power to amend prospectively. The word prospectively was used in terms. The banks, and I don't just blame Enron for this. I blame Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, AIG, as Larry Summers said when he berated Brooks Lee for doing it, I have 13 bankers in my office who say you're going to cause the worst crisis since World War II. The banks kept saying, oh, she's going to undo the old market. And she kept saying, no, I'm talking about the future.
Martin Bailey, were you privy to any of these conversations?
I was not part of the conversation or part of the decision to not to regulate derivatives. And as I said earlier, I think that was a decision that was a mistake. They should have allowed more control over derivatives. I do think the discussion that we're getting into has that slight exaggerated sense of, A, how important the derivatives were to the crisis that we're in. This notional value of the derivatives is, I think, relatively meaningless in terms of the size of the crisis. Most of this crisis has come because of mortgage defaults and defaults on other kinds of assets. And I might also say that simply regulating something doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a good outcome. We had rooms full of regulators in the banks. We had rooms full of regulators at Citibank, and that didn't stop them from going down. As a matter of fact, the Office of Thrift Supervision knew perfectly well that AIG was issuing all these derivatives, and they didn't do anything about it. So a big part of what we've seen is actually a failure by the regulators themselves to keep control of the system,
however,
not just a lack of regulation.
However, you heard Michael Greenberger talk about the fact that these derivatives are now at something like a $500 trillion level, still without the kind of regulation that Brooksley Borton was calling for going forward. Are you not at all concerned that the same problem could rise again?
I think Brooksley Borton was a hero, and I had the opportunity...
An unsung hero.
A heroine, I should say. And I had the opportunity to testify in front of the commission that's been appointed to look at the causes of the crisis, and she's a member of that commission. So I don't want to overstate my disagreement with what's been said here. The fact that there are 500 trillion of derivatives outstanding, even in and of itself, does not worry me.
Why not?
Well, why would it? I mean, these things are financial assets that are used for. We have a very large global economy, and these things are playing an important role in that. Just throwing out that number, I don't think.
Diane, I really have to say something here. Let's just look at AIG. With $200 billion in equity, one of their many subsidiaries guaranteed the investments in subprime mortgages. They set a floor through insurance. They issued $400 billion in insurance without a single penny put aside for capital. Because as Martin said, they thought housing prices would always go up and this would never be a problem. You and Greg and Martin and I have bailed AIG out. They didn't have the money for the insurance. Now, by the way, who got the money? The money went to AIG in the front door, and out the back door, it went to Goldman Sachs and 13 of the world's largest banks who bet that people would not be able to pay their mortgages.
Greg.
Diane, I just want to... make a small explanation for our listeners about where this $500 trillion figure comes from. Imagine that I have a house that's worth $100,000 and I promise to pay you 1% of the value of the house at the end of a year, $1,000. The way we measure the value of that contract is the value of the house, $100,000. But that $100,000 is not actually at risk because I'm not going to lose my house. The $1,000 is what's at risk. So the $500 trillion figure you hear is what we call the notional value, but the actual amount of value at risk is quite a bit smaller. However, the numbers are still quite large, and the intrinsic nature of derivatives is that they allow considerable amounts of leverage, which is to say that the amount of money at risk can change quite a lot in a very short period of time, depending on how the underlying thing that you're basing the contract on changes.
So,
and if you had allowed me to finish my earlier sentence, thank you, Greg, because that explains why this $500 trillion is an inflated number. I think it clearly was wrong that AIG could issue these derivatives without capital, and it is being proposed by the administration that capital requirements be applied to these derivatives now, and that is something I support.
But yes, and why has it taken so long? Is the question, considering when this meltdown first began to occur a year ago, and Brooksley Borton was talking about this years before that, why is it taking so long, Greg?
Well, Diane... Oh.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, because we passed the law in 2000, which essentially shut the whole discussion down, we basically had to restart the entire process over again. Now, you could actually say that given that AIG was 1 year ago, we're actually moving at considerable speed. The last major regulatory reform we had in this country was 10 years in the works. But I think the question you're asking is, why hasn't anything happened yet? We have actually got some things happening. Last week, Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, did pass a bill that incorporates a lot of the changes that Brooks Lee Bourne called for 10 years ago. Now, to be sure, there are some important exceptions, and there's a vigorous debate going on right now about whether those exceptions significantly weaken the regulation of derivatives that we should have.
I want our listeners to know that Brooks Lee Bourne was the subject of a Frontline piece that aired just the other night. We invited her on the program this morning. She was flying to San Francisco. We hope to hear from her at a later date. Greg Ipp is U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers waiting. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Let's go to Tom, who's here in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been in the wealth management business for about 10 years, and I'm a registered principal, and I find all this extremely fascinating. I once held in my hand a futures contract written on a cuneiform tablet from thousands of years ago, from what was then Babylon. It's fascinating stuff. The challenge that we have is that, number one, the wealth management companies, since the market dropped, have been firing their compliance departments and making do with fewer compliance officers to oversee these transactions. And the other is what was just brought up. That is to say, a person can, with $5 of money, buy $100 worth of futures contracts, which means that if the futures contract goes down 5%, he no longer has any money. He's going to be called on a Reg T. The Reg T on stocks is that if you have $2, you can buy $1 worth of stock, one additional dollar worth of stock, without selling anything, without having additional cash. So you see that this can easily get out of hand, especially when the regulators, SEC is understaffed, FINRA is understaffed, and now the Wall Street banks, the wealth managers, are understaffed. So this very easily gets out of hand.
All right. Thanks for calling. Greg Ipp.
Well, that comes as a surprise to hear that wealth management companies are firing compliance people. The anecdotal evidence was the opposite, so that's very worrisome. But let's talk a little bit about, how risky the situation is going forward. Now, we've seen companies like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs report their earnings in the last week or so, and what you discover is that they're still making a huge amount of their money by trading things. So it's a legitimate thing to say, well, are things just as risky? My own view is they're probably not. Because of the trauma inflicted by the crisis of the last year or two, the riskiest of these derivatives have basically been flushed out of the system. And in fact, the latest data do tell us that the amount outstanding of these dangerous credit derivatives has fallen roughly by half. But I think that there are problems waiting in the wings, and they come from a couple of sources. The first is that the government has essentially put its guarantee behind the entire financial system. They felt they had to do that to stop it from melting down. But what that means is that all the companies that are either explicitly or implicitly covered by that guarantee, whether it's your community bank or Goldman Sachs, are now able to borrow excessively cheaply because all their lenders think, well, if Goldman Sachs goes down, the government will bail me out. That is a license for them to take excessive risk, and we still do not have the regulatory mechanism in place to suppress that risk-taking. The other thing that I just wanted to mention here is that the essence of the changes to the laws we're going to have on derivatives is that we're going to centralize this trading on exchanges. Much as you trade stocks through the New York Stock Exchange, these swaps will now be traded through something like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the New York Mercantile Exchange. Sounds like a good idea, right? Instead of Goldman Sachs trading with Bank of America, Goldman Sachs will trade with the exchange. Bank of America will trade with the exchange. Why is that a good thing? Well, if Goldman Sachs goes down, instead of that being a problem for Bank of America, that'll be a problem of the exchange. Now, hopefully, the exchange will have lots and lots of capital and collateral, and it won't be a problem. But it's entirely possible that the opposite will happen, that so much risk will become concentrated in this one place that the failure of one big firm like a Goldman Sachs could bring the entire system down.
Are you concerned about that as well, Martin Bailey?
Yes, I think we have to make sure that these exchanges or clearinghouses have adequate amount of capital to deal with the situation. I think it actually would be a mistake to require that all derivatives be traded on exchanges, because there's also a role for customized derivatives that are not on exchanges.
Martin Bailey of the Brookings Institution. We'll take just a short break. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
There's no such thing as a dumb dog. But God knows there are continents filled with dumb humans, so says Rita Mae Brown, the best-selling author on what she's learned about herself and other people from the dogs, cats, horses, birds, and rabbits in her life. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're talking about the derivative market. Michael Greenberger, I want to ask you about Larry Summers' role in the failure of that derivatives market, if we can call it a crisis. Does he concern you as the director of the President's Economic Advisory Council?
Well, let me say, as I said in the Frontline piece, and Brooksley does not want to comment on the record, he was extremely rough with her in trying to convince her not to go forward, shouting at her and using other what I would call bullying tactics. That having been said, the Obama administration put out a white paper in June that satisfied me and many other reformers, because it said all these products essentially, save a few, have to be traded on exchange. When the administration sent its legislation up, it said, except if it deals with foreign currency, which is what brought down one of the biggest hedge funds, or except if a non-banker is a counterparty, which means everybody else except banks. On August 17th, Gary Gensler, who, by the way, was a Summers and Rubin protege in the Clinton administration, is now the chair of the CFTC, former Goldman partner, wrote a letter and said, these are exceptions that swallow the rule. So on the one hand, and this is what is happening today, people are saying we're fixing it. But when you read the details, there are exceptions that swallow the rule. That's true of the Obama administration. It is even more true of the financial services legislation that went out last week. It is even more true of the Ag Committee's reports yesterday. When we say, will exchange trading work, my compadres in this, which are the unions, the environmentalists, the consumer groups, Consumer Federation of America, investor protection groups, they believe that the law will end up being worse than the law that was passed in 2000, which Brooksley Bourne complained about.
Martin Bailey.
I think Gary Gensler is right to warn against a dilution of the regulation. But at the same time, I think some of the efforts are being made is to sort of throttle financial markets altogether, and I don't think that's the right answer. We need a financial system that is robust. We can't expect that companies will never go down or that failures will never occur. We just want to have in place institutions which will allow those failures to occur without bringing down the whole economy. So success and failure are part of our financial system, and I don't think we should overregulate it so we always prevent these things from happening.
Greg Gibb.
The people who advocate these exceptions, there is a point to what they're saying. Now, financial contracts come in a wide variety of types and sizes. Now, the case for trading like the stock of international business machines on a stock exchange is cut and dried. IBM has billions of shares, and each share is exactly like the other one, and hundreds of millions of them trade every day. So everybody who goes to buy or sell a share of IBM, they know what they're getting. But when you get down to some of these derivatives contracts, they get pretty obscure and pretty tailored to the needs of a particular company. I need to borrow euros and swap them into yen for exactly 93 days for exactly this amount of money. And it's very hard to find a lot of people with exactly the same needs. And therefore, if all those types of contracts must be traded on an exchange, there will be no volume, and that could actually drive up prices. The trick for the regulators now is what's the dividing line? Because you can be quite certain that those who want to trade things out of the oversight of regulators because it's more profitable, for example, will look for exceptions and try to exploit them. That's more or less how we got AIG. AIG traded these products through a non-bank subsidiary precisely to avoid the higher costs and the tougher oversight of some of its regulators.
Here's an email from Rick who says, tell me if this is correct. Number one, Goldman Sachs buys credit default swaps, insures them through AIG for $12 billion. Number two, CDs fail. AIG requires $185 billion bailout. Three, AIG pays Goldman Sachs $12 billion in insurance. Number four, Goldman Sachs declares bonuses of $16 billion. Goldman Sachs basically insured a bad bet with an unregulated insurance policy that the Fed needed to bail out, thus allowing capitalist gains and socialized losses.
Absolutely correct. Goldman Sachs made a decision over the summer of 2007 that the subprime mortgages would fail. So they went to, it wasn't just AIG, they went to Lehman, Bear Stearns, and said, we want the insurance. The insurers never asked, are you holding any of the instruments? In other words, it's like insuring somebody else's house knowing it's going to be set on fire. The money that went to AIG, which is your money and all of us here, went in the front door and out the back door, not $12 billion, $13 billion to Goldman Sachs, whose CEO was in the meeting on September 16th deciding whether AIG would be saved by the American taxpayer. If the American taxpayer, who does not come up in any of these discussions, we're worried about ExxonMobil and Cargill and whether they're going to have to pay for regulation. The American taxpayer is not represented in this fight, and Brooksley Bourne believes, and I believe, if we don't get true, meaningful regulation, we're going to go through this cycle again, and every time it comes back, it's worse.
All right.
Well, come on. We were in the middle of a financial crisis. A decision was made that when the AIG went down, the people who had purchased the insurance contracts would be paid off 100%. With the benefit of hindsight, I think that was probably a mistake. They should have been given what we call a haircut. That's to say they weren't paid off every dollar. They would have been paid off part of what they what they were owed. Now, remember that folks like Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke were dealing with a financial crisis, which is having a massive effect on taxpayers and on people and their jobs. And they were trying under an extremely stressful situation to make sure that our financial system and our economy did not collapse. They didn't make every decision right, but I would point out to you the economy is recovering, the financial sector is recovering, so they did it right.
All right, let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the unemployment rate stands at 15%. William, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm retired.
I
want to know how $17 trillion worth of mortgages can be insured for $60 trillion.
I'm not sure I understand
you. I understand
he's saying. Okay, go ahead.
People bought the insurance who didn't own any stake in the mortgages. 3 to 8 times the number of insurance that was sold to somebody who had exposure to a subprime loan were bought by people who said, these people are never going to pay their mortgages. I want to take a bet. Now, in the insurance law, you can't buy insurance on someone else's life, car, property, home, but AIG was selling it to anybody who wanted it.
All right.
And we still don't know whether Goldman was exposed to risk or just made a bet. And we paid the bet off 100 cents on the dollar.
Let's go to Scott in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Great show.
Thanks.
Listen, I'd like to look a little bit on how we got here. Can you guys comment on two questions? Senator Phil Graham put in a Commodities Futures Modernization Act that basically had an explosion of unregulated securities that created the CDSs in 2000. And then we had, I believe it was Christopher Cox, who was head of the SEC. Instead of keeping the 1 to 10 leverage, we went to a 1 to 40 leverage. Could you guys comment on these two things?
Great.
Well, even though this show has been about derivatives and it's appropriate to discuss the role they had in aggravating the crisis, I think that I agree with Martin that they aren't really the prime suspect. In fact, I'm not sure what the prime suspect is. It's like Murder on the Orient Express. Everybody did it. I mean, who do we blame? The successive Democratic and Republican administrations that pushed the industry and the and everybody involved in housing to get everybody to own their own home? Do we blame the Federal Reserve for keeping interest rates too low? Do we blame the subprime mortgages? Do we blame the derivatives that were written on the subprime mortgages?
Greg Ipp, the Economist, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Greg, are you saying there are too many people to blame so you can't blame anybody?
It's society's fault.
No, I mean, yes. Yes, indeed.
If I have a chance, I'd like to comment on
that. Go right ahead.
Well, I think it's people invested in these risky investments because they thought they had insurance. Talk to George Soros. He will tell you. The thought that you had insurance that wasn't capitalized in the end would allow you to invest in the proposition that people who didn't have adequate credit would pay their mortgages. There were many, many abuses, but the faulty, phony insurance was, in my view, and I think in many people's view, the engine that drove the meltdown.
All right. To Sycamore, Illinois, good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Congress failed us in the Clinton administration. Congress failed us when they let the bankers who caused this hand out the TARP money with no conditions. The greedy bankers are making money, but they're not making loans for this economy to recover. And I'm hearing that AIG, even though it's been saved, will never pay back the TARP money. It's time to elect no incumbents. Send a strong message to Congress that they have to listen to their constituents and not to the corporations and their lobbyists with their slush funds.
It's going to take a long time to get there, isn't it, Martin Bailey?
Well, there is some truth in what's said. I think lobbyists have too much power, and maybe some large corporations have too much power. But I don't think we should get carried away with a populist view that's all that's responsible. Remember, a lot of individuals who borrowed money on their houses didn't always tell the truth about their own financial situation. They borrowed too much. And so, as Greg said, I think there are a lot of people that were responsible. One thing I will say, though, in agreement with what my colleagues have been saying, there was an atmosphere, I think, that developed starting in the 1970s that went all the way through that somehow deregulation was going to solve everything. And it applied to airlines, it applied to electricity, it applied to the financial sector. And so I think we, in many cases, deregulation was a good thing, but in some of these cases, we went way too far on deregulation, and we have to step back and review what we need.
But according to Michael Greenberger, it sounds as though what's being considered in the way of new regulation may in fact miss essential portions of what's needed to curb this result.
Well, I don't think so, because I think there is going to be significant encouragement to move these derivatives onto exchanges. And if you don't trade on an exchange, you're going to have a higher capital requirement. So there will be a financial incentive to put these derivatives onto exchanges. And I think that's probably the right way to go about it. I don't think we should over-regulate this market.
Great.
Diane, I don't know what the next crisis is going to be, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to be credit derivatives. It's just the nature of crises and our response to them that we end up, you know, putting up all sorts of regulations and solutions to the crisis we just had. And we have a fundamental failure of imagination to think about where the next one is going to be. Now, one of the elements that draws all the things we've been talking about together, whether it's subprime mortgages or derivatives, is that it's the nature of our dynamic capitalist, wealth-seeking society to always try and find a new clever way to produce a new product, whether it's an iPod, a drug, or a derivative. And so wherever the exceptions are, that is where I guarantee that the innovation and risk-taking is going
okay.
to flourish.
And what bothers me is that the people who are able to envision what the risks are for these kinds of new things, new problems, you're saying may come up, won't be listened to.
Well, if I can add to that, they're not being listened to today. And this idea, you know, these callers call up and they're justifiably angry. I can tell you there are 5 bank lobbyists for every member of Congress who are working on these so-called re-regulatory bills. And the device that is being used is to say, as a general matter, things will be regulated. Don't bother to read the fine print. There aren't enough average people whose voices are being heard. The voices that are being heard is those of the banks, and they have got their customers, in other words, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the American Petroleum Institute, to come and say, regulation's expensive. What isn't being asked is, how expensive is deregulation to the taxpayer?
Well, how do you propose that the taxpayer voice be heard now?
Well, I was on the Hill when gasoline hit $4 a gallon, and people called, faxed, emailed, and screamed at their members of Congress to do something. Right now, the banks are faxing, meeting, voicing, 5 lobbyists for every member of Congress. People who are listening, who agree with what I'm saying and are worried, should be on the phone, faxing, emailing their member of Congress, and saying, please do what President Obama promised in writing and at his Wall Street speech. These instruments, without exception, should be regulated. What is happening is, Democratic members of Congress, I'm ashamed to say, is these instruments are going to be regulated. Don't read the fine print. The fine print says no regulation.
What do you think, Martin Bailey?
We live in a democracy. If people don't like what's done, they should vote for someone else to change it. It's appropriate for banks to have a voice in what's going on, but it is appropriate that consumer groups also have a voice, and they do have a voice in what's happening.
Enough of a voice, Greg Gibb.
Well, I think so, but you can often ask whether the voices that are heard are the right ones. For example, in our country, we hate big banks and we like small ones. Well, the small banks were hurt, and that is why there is a very large exception in the consumer protection legislation for small banks.
Greg, yeah, but the economist Michael Greenberger, University of Maryland, Martin Bailey, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.